supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a lot of folks have a dream of growing a, quote, giant sequoia somewhere on their property. Can it be done? What exactly do we mean when we say giant sequoia? We'll look into this world of titanic trees and reveal how you might be able to grow something that lasts 1,000 years or more. Otherwise, it's a fascinating phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Simi, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Simi. How are you?
I'm doing great. In Kingston, New Jersey.
In Kingston, New Jersey. You know the routine. Very good. What can we do for Simi in Kingston?
3 years ago, my husband and I moved to New Jersey, and we bought a piece of land that has gorgeous big trees on it. So one question is about a great big copper beech tree that looks like someone long ago backed a truck into.
You'd be surprised at how many car accidents we deal with on this show.
It's not a new injury, and one side of the tree, the bark, is all broken and rotting, and we had great big white bracket fungi growing on it. What can we do to nurse it back to health?
First of all, the only thing that defines future death in a tree is for the trunk to be interrupted in a complete circle called girdling. If the bark is totally gone in a complete circle, then the tree will die because that's the only part of the tree that's carrying water up to the canopy is right underneath the bark. And if that's damaged completely around, there ain't no water pipes left. Damage to one side or a big chunk may look scary to us, but the way to tell is not to look at the injury itself, but to pay careful attention to the leafing out of the canopy in the spring, because the beech is a deciduous tree. It's dropping its leaves. It's going to regrow them in the spring. If you start to see problems with the tree leafing out, that's when you want to call in an expert to evaluate the long-term chances of the tree. Now, a mushroom growing out the side shows that there is dead wood in there. But there's really no good answer to that. I know people hate to hear it, but the honest answer is just don't look at it. Anything we would do in terms of sealants or other things would be more damaging.
Well, then I guess that takes me to my other question, which is how do I find that expert if next spring I look up and the canopy looks like it's not doing so well?
You really want a professional arborist who went to school for it, who has a degree in it, who is certified, and who obviously knows what they're doing. Now, one of the issues is even people like that might want to sell you a lot of unnecessary things. So my rules would be if the tree is leafing out, and you just got this guy on your property doing evaluation and he wants to start doing injections and feedings and stuff like that, then lose his phone number. If he wants to, he or she wants to trim or prune healthy wood, that's green wood, that's wood that has green leaves on it, it's not damaged. If they want to do that any time other than in the dead of winter, that's something you need to call them out on. I mean, it could be perfectly necessary to prune off some branches to increase airflow to the other plants, to get a branch off your roof, yada, yada. But that pruning should only be done after the dormant period or soon after the tree begins growing again in spring. Somebody wants to prune now, lose their number. Because the trees are going dormant, pruning stimulates growth. The worst thing you can do for any perennial plant is to prune it now. So trees don't need to be fed. They don't need to be mulched. Trees often need to have the mulch removed if the mulch is anywhere near the trunk. Someone who plants a tree so that it looks like a lollipop instead of having the big root flare above ground, they're a loser too. And on our website, we have questions to ask a lawn care provider before you sign up for a contract. These are the similar questions you would ask an arborist. Now, I will amend that to say if there's dead, diseased parts in the tree, they should come down as soon as they're noticed. And other than that, I mean, we're all grown-ups. We know when we're dealing with a professional, and those are the keys. Healthy parts only get pruned in the winter or spring. Dead or diseased stuff comes down right away. But trees don't need added nutrition, and they don't need mulch piled up around their base. Anybody who leans in that direction is a bad actor.
Well, thanks, Mike.
All right, Simi, good luck. You're asking the right questions.
Thanks a lot.
Take
bye
care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Michael, how are you, sir?
Good. I'm doing well. Thank you.
And where is Michael doing well?
I am doing well in Fishtown, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
A suburb of beautiful Port Richmond.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
What can we do for you, Michael?
Well, I have an orange tree, a small, it bears like 1.5-inch diameter oranges, and it was given to me as a gift about 12, 13 years ago, and it was already 15 years old at that point. So I'm thinking that it's about 30 years old. It's got a trunk on it about 3 inches around, and it grows to about 7 feet. I have it in a large pot that I keep indoors in this wintertime, and I put it on my own hand truck rig that I rigged up, and I move it into my backyard in the summertime. So what's happening is, like 2 years ago, it started to not bear fruit, and I was thinking that it might be root-bound. So what I did was I took it in the backyard, and I laid it down, and I thinned out the root. I thinned it out considerably, about 50%. And put it back in the same pot, and it survived, but,
yeah.
it didn't shock it too bad, and I was concerned about what my timing was when I did that. I wasn't sure about what the cycle is on orange trees.
Well, when did you do it?
You know, I think I did it in the spring of last year.
Okay.
Not this past year, but the year before.
Okay.
So it's had a complete summer in it, and it's grown a little bit of greenage, but still no fruit. I got some blossoms, which are delightful. They they smell wonderful.
Now, in the past, before your attempted homicide, what time of year did you get oranges?
In the wintertime, January, February, March.
Right, that's my understanding. Oddly enough, that's when my bird of paradise blooms, if it's going to. So you say it's got some green leaves, but your hack job really maimed it for a while, huh?
Yeah, I think it's been in shock. I'm just concerned that I shock it for a 2-year cycle. You know, and I had to prune some dried branches off it too, so I tried to keep them in tight.
Okay, so now is it back inside now?
No, it's not. It's still outside.
Why?
Well, I'm getting ready to bring it back in because
okay.
it's just starting to cool off. It's 80 degrees in Philadelphia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Daytime highs, you can get 80 degrees in freaking December. When you're bringing in tropical plants, you want to bring them in before the first night drops into the 40s. Now, you got a little bit more wiggle room being in the middle of the city than I do, but back inside sooner is better than later, because shock can knock all the flowers off and delay. Have you been feeding this poor thing?
I've been a little scared to feed it because I don't know exactly what to give it.
And are the leaves green and glossy?
The leaves are very green and very glossy.
Okay, you're in good shape. Get this puppy back inside. And then what I want you to do, it's time to give it a gentle feeding. Go out to a good garden center, an independent garden center. Get a real high-quality bagged compost, something that is really well made, not just something from one of the big box stores that's in a white bag that has compost stamped on it, and not composted manure. You want good compost. You want to put a 2-inch layer of compost on the surface of the soil in that pot, and then every time you water it, it'll get a nice feeding. These citrus trees are the opposite of other houseplants. Most houseplants should not be fed at all in the fall and winter, and their water should be cut back. As you know from experience, this is when citrus tends to bloom and fruit. So we're going to bring it in. We're going to mitigate that heat as much as we can. We're going to put a 2-inch layer of compost on the surface of the pot. We're not going to overwater it, but we're not going to be stingy. And then the next time flowers appear, I want you to get a little paintbrush and have sex with the flowers. I want you to take the pollen from one flower and move it around to the others. And that'll greatly increase your chance of seeing fruits again.
Well, thank you very much, and have a good day.
You
okay?
Too.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will be the lead speaker for the Cape May Food Day celebration this coming Friday, October 10th. The outdoor and indoor event will feature cooking demonstrations, a farmer's market, and me. The event runs from 11 to 3 at the Cape May County Extension Office in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the tallest trees in the world and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, they are the tallest, most impressive, longest-lived plants in the world. We call them all giant sequoias, but there are two different giant tall trees. Can you grow either one? We'll answer that burning question when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's time to burn through more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I'm doing good, Jeff. How are you, sir?
Great. We listen to you all the time, and I finally got a chance to call in with one of my questions.
Excellent, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Vineland, New Jersey.
The Garden State, so you must be accomplished.
Well, somewhat. A friend of mine gave me two little 3-inch twigs that he said were going to be fig trees one day, and They had a couple of roots on the bottom. I planted them earlier in the summer. And I've got two fig trees that are about 2 feet tall. The leaves are like 9 inches by 8 inches.
Aren't they? If you've never grown figs before or haven't paid attention, the size and shape of the leaf always knocks you out, doesn't it?
It really does. It's beautiful. My question is this. I have them in two pots. They're about 20 inches wide,
mm-hmm.
and about 16 to 18 inches tall. And with the winter coming, I don't think it's a good idea to leave them on the back deck. They'll just, I'm afraid they're going to freeze. And I know a lot of people plant them on the south side of their homes or against a wall. I have two questions. Number one, should I plant them now, or should I bring them in the pots in the garage for the winter and then plant them in the spring?
You got two, right?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to split them up.
Right.
Think of an area on your landscape that can accommodate the size of a full-grown fig tree. We're talking something that over the course of a summer will like reach 12 or 15 feet in height and be like 5 or 6 feet wide on either side. But the area needs to be protected. Fig trees need to be protected from the desiccating winter winds of the northeast. So in a corner, against a wall, but not too close to a wall. Something like that would be the ideal location. Also in an area that drains well. It can't hold water.
All right.
You pick your site. The soil doesn't have to be good, and don't improve it. Figs grow in poor soil. So you're going to take it out of its pot, and you're going to plant it in the ground, trying not to disturb the root system so that we're not shocking the poor plant. But this is a perfect time to put the plant in the ground. And then what I want you to do is drive a couple of stakes in the ground around the plant and wrap burlap around the stakes, okay. Not around the plant.
Correct.
Around the stakes. And then just throw some burlap over the top. Take the other one, I guess in this case, the one that's in the terracotta pot, and put it where it's going to go dormant, which is, you know, like in a cold garage. Protected from freezing, but the cooler the better otherwise.
Now, my second half to this question, if we're planning on moving in, let's say, 1 or 2 years, is there a way to be able to plant this in such a way that I can make it easier to take it with me later?
Fig trees are so fertile, for lack of a better word, that you'll take cuttings in spring and they'll grow new fig trees for you at your new location.
Oh, that's super. That'll be
good. And the one that's in the terracotta pot should be put in the ground in the spring. And then if you just want a one-year wonder, that can be anywhere, out in the open, in full sun, unprotected in the spring and summer will give you the most figs. And then you can take cuttings from that plant or if you have another protected location. But if you got two, it'd be crazy not to plant one and store one.
Okay, that's great. All right, I really want to thank you for all the information you gave me. That really helps me now.
All right, good luck, Jeff.
All right, good. And I enjoy listening to you every week.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Opal, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I'm so glad that you took my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Opal. How are you?
I'm fine today, and you are?
I am excellent. Thank you for asking. Where is Opal fine?
I am calling from Shreveport, Louisiana.
Ah, very good. Very good. What can we do for you?
Well, Mike, I bought a pineapple, cut the top off, put it in water, and it actually took sprouts. Now, I'm talking about this pineapple plant. It was last year's plant.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me a pineapple this year.
Right.
I kept it living throughout the winter. On cold days, we bought it in the house. Hot days, we took it outside for the sun. And it got the size of maybe like two grapefruits together.
Right.
Nice sized pineapple. But when I pulled it, it was very, very hard, so I didn't think it was going to be edible. However, we cut it. I put it in a fruit bowl arrangement, and after about 4 days, it started to soften. So I thought it was going to be bad. Well, then I said, well, worst case scenario, let me peel it and we'll see. I peeled it. It was very easy to peel, and the aroma of the pineapple just set the kitchen on fire. Long story short, it was very, very sweet, and I was amazed that I actually grew a pineapple from the pineapple top. My question for you is, I still have that plant. Will it bear another pineapple? Do I dispose of it? Does a pineapple plant just bear one fruit, or should I get many?
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited.
It is very easy to cut the top off of a pineapple and to get a stalk. And then to do you remember the flower that appeared before the pineapple?
Yes, it had a little purple hue.
Wasn't it beautiful?
It was really, really, really beautiful.
First of all, it's a great thing for children to do. You cut the top off of a pineapple. You make sure the leaves are green and healthy and not all browned out and ruined. And then most people just sit it in a saucer of water. And I
eventually put it in some soil because I actually got little tiny sprouts from
exactly.
the first one.
Right.
Now,
so
the second one didn't sprout.
You mean when you tried to do your done thing?
No, I thought I might have needed to have a mate, a male, female.
Oh, I see.
So I cut off another pineapple, and it didn't sprout, but I put it in dirt anyway, and it grew.
Mm-hmm.
But only one gave me a fruit, and the other one sort of kind of died.
Well, there's a couple things going on here. First of all, the one that worked for you was nice and green and healthy. And then the second one may have been older. Once those leaves start to lose their chlorophyll, this trick won't work. And some of these things are treated with sprouting inhibitors in conventional supermarkets. So, but it is a lot of fun. It's okay to get it to start to display roots in water. But then as quickly as possible, you should plant it in a good-sized pot with a lot of compost in it. And give it good light. Now, one of the reasons you got an edible pineapple is where you are in Louisiana, you're not that far away from where people can grow things like this outside all year long. So you're much closer, for instance, to the equator than we are here in Pennsylvania. What typically we get when we play around with this is we will get a stalk that will grow out of the top of the old pineapple, and then we'll get that beautiful purple flower, which is, you know, flower doesn't even begin to describe it. It's almost like a bromeliad.
Yes, it was very beautiful.
And then a lot of times you'll get a little miniature pineapple that will stay very small. The fact that you achieved one of a good size, it's not unheard of, but it's really remarkable. And I think it was a combination of the fact that you started with a fruit whose leaves were still green and fresh and vibrant and could absorb sunlight. You treated it correctly, and putting it outside in Louisiana, you know, it's not Central America, but it's a lot closer than Chicago.
Yes, yes. Will I get another fruit? Because it's still green and healthy, would it bear another pineapple? Or
if you have the room, I would continue to grow it out. Now, at this point, you'll have to feed it. Make sure there's a lot of compost going into that pot. But certainly, you know, since you had your success, I wouldn't hesitate to buy pineapples in season. Really look for those green leaves. And
I do.
And get, you know, so far you're batting 500, which means all the teams are clamoring for you. With your climate, I think you were able to actually give it the kind of sunlight and conditions that allowed an edible pineapple to mature for you. That's amazing. You know, you get yourself like 100 of these, you can go into business, Opal.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call and taking the time.
Oh, no, thank you for sharing a wonderful story. There's people getting in their cars to go pineapple shopping right now.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well,
appreciate that.
Thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Piper'sville, Bucks County.
I know that area well. That's a beautiful area of Bucks County.
Absolutely beautiful.
What can we do for Tom in Piper'sville?
Here's my question. It's in regards to horseradish. My question is that I've grown it for many years, always make my own horseradish, and I moved to a new location. And in doing so, I took some of the roots with me and replanted them into new soil, which I wasn't familiar with. But it was very humus-type soil, really nice. It was a previous garden there, and the soil seemed really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, these will do well because you know how deep they go and how vibrant they are as they grow. And they so I planted them, and they grew really well. They got the big leaves. They got real tall and looked real healthy, and I thought I was going to have trophy roots. And now, if you can correct me, the way I always understood it was the time that they are the hottest is in the fall when the leaf dies back. That seems to enhance the hotness of the root. Now, I don't know if that's a wise tale. You can correct me on that. But that's the way I always understood it. So whenever I made it was always in the fall. So now it's fall here in Bucks County, and I was attempting to take a few roots out to see what they look like. And previously, about a month ago, they were looking really good, and then they started to die off. And I thought that was kind of odd. And we got very dry here, and I didn't water them, thinking that they were a hardy enough thing because they were very hard to kill off as a rule, and they multiply pretty vibrantly. So I didn't really take too much time in watering them. And I don't know whether that was my fault that they died off like they did. But now when I dig them up, the root is mostly kind of rotted away. They're kind of brownish half of a root. And I don't know whether that's related to the lack of me watering them maybe or whether something has done that to them. I want to get your opinion on that.
Okay. Now, in your old place, did you sell your house?
Yes.
So what was different? What was different about the old house? Is this an area in your new home that, you know, it has been a little dry lately, but we had a lot of rain over the summer. We also did not have almost any heat waves over the summer. Is this an area that drains poorly or collected water?
Well, actually, it drains very well. This garden happens to be a raised bed garden, and it's very humus-type soil, dark in color, almost like potting soil, very light, easy to till, and most things in there did well.
Okay, now, what about the old place?
Level to the ground, I don't know what else to tell you. It wasn't that type of soil.
Okay, and when and what exactly did you plant? Did you take some of your roots from the previous home and plant them at the new home?
Correct.
When did you plant them?
In the spring.
Okay.
Of this past year, and they did great. They came up, they got tall, and they looked very hardy.
And you didn't do any harvesting?
No, not at all, till recently.
Are they growing near a treated lawn?
No.
Did anybody near you spray herbicides?
None.
Okay.
Zero.
Horseradish, like raspberries, does best in poor soil, can become invasive. Do you have any relationship with the people who bought your house?
Certainly.
Okay. I think you should go back and harvest some of your old horseradish, which they would probably be thrilled for you to do. And at the same time, I would take some of those roots and chop them up and plant them in less nice soil on your property. Believe me, when you go back to your old house, there's going to be horseradish all over the place. Let's be honest
about
it.
Right, which always was, yeah.
Right, these roots get out of control really easy. So bring back a ton of it and you use some. And then plant some in different locations. I don't know what went wrong in your raised beds. That it sounds really funky. Rotting is wetness, period. Horseradish, because it is mostly a root, a big fleshy root, retains water really well. That's one of the last plants that's going to succumb to drought. And to answer a question from like 5 minutes ago, Heat comes from stress, same as in hot peppers. Going without water for long periods of time will make horseradish hotter. Hot summers, hot, dry summers will make horseradish hotter.
Even in the old house, Mike, I had some of that rot every now and then on the roots. It's something that's almost eaten away at them as if it were a fungus or a bacteria.
Now I think you've identified it. You had a disease at your old place and you brought it to the new place. So when you go back and harvest, just harvest perfect roots. You're going to have your pick of hundreds. Just harvest perfect roots. If the root next to it is rotten, don't take that. Only find some good clumps where there's no disease at all in there, and then bring those back to your house, use about half of it, and then chop up the rest and plant it in like six different locations.
Now, how about the ones that are currently in there?
I would throw them away. I would try to get as many of them out as I could. Other than that, I would not plant new horseradish in there so that when the plants come up, you know to dig those up and throw them away.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
You want to get rid of your diseased stock. Okay, Tom?
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Yeah.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you that I will be the lead speaker for the Cape May Food Day celebration this Friday, October 10th, from 11 to 3 at the Cape May County Extension Office in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. The outdoor and indoor event will feature cooking demonstrations at Farmer's Market and me talking about all the things you can grow now and through the winter. That's Friday, October 10th at the Cape May County Extension Office in Cape May Courthouse, New Jersey. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the two big trees we'd all like to grow and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Grand American Tours. In July of 2015, Mike McGrath will be hosting a Viking river cruise through the gardens of Provence. More at 800-423-0247 or grandamericantours.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll tell you what chance you have of growing a, quote, giant sequoia or the other big tree that exists out on the West Coast naturally that you want to grow unnaturally. Well, maybe you can. Other people have. We'll explain after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Bob. Where are you?
Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, in the middle of the country.
Always a pleasure to hear from our friends down there. We love our listeners in Oklahoma. What can we do for Bob in OK?
Well, I have a pear tree that's about 8 foot tall. I planted it a couple of years ago, and I've noticed in the last 2 weeks a bunch of the leaves are turning upside down, which is kind of strange. And the only thing I've done in the last month is fertilize it with some Miracle-Gro.
Oh, why did you do that?
Oh, whoops. Well, I guess I didn't know any better.
Well, first of all, we're getting towards the end of the season. And
yeah,
one of the rules of any kind of fruit trees is, for God's sake, never feed them past July. It's actually safer to do all of your feeding in the spring, because after they've produced their fruits, when they're ripening their fruits up, they're using stored nutrition. They're thinking about going dormant for the winter. And then you hit them not only with fertilizer, but with chemical fertilizer that they have no choice. If they're growing in rich soil, they can take what they want and leave the rest behind. But you're like injecting them with steroids when you do that Miracle-Gro. And that gave them a burst of unnatural energy that caused a late growth spurt that has probably confused the tree. Now, is it mulched?
No, it's not.
Okay, good, good. Have you fed it before this?
I fed it in spring some tree spikes.
Oh, those are terrible too, Bob. I call those the spikes of death. Now, do we have some nice-looking pears on the tree?
I did at the beginning, earlier in the summer until the birds decided to eat them all. But
oh, okay. So you know now next year you've got to invest in bird netting.
Okay.
The nice thing about pears is they don't need a lot of constant attention. The only thing you should be feeding this tree is some compost, a mulch of an inch or two of compost every spring. That'll give the tree all the nutrients it needs, and it'll be natural, slow-release nutrients. Now, you say after you use the chemical fertilizer, your leaves turned upside down, and while the fruit was there, it looked fine.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Okay. Have you noticed any yellowing of the leaves or any black schmutz on them?
No, I have not.
Okay. Because, you know, leaves that curl on a pear tree are typically the result of an attack by aphids. And aphids love going after plants that have been chemically fed. It attracts them. So one thing I want you to do is go out and really take a look at some of these turned around leaves and rub your hand over a couple of them and see if you get all messy. See if there's little tiny insects all over those leaves. And if there are, I want you to get a garden hose and early in the morning get up close and just spray really hard on those affected leaves. Blast the aphids off, because that's what it sounds like. Otherwise, don't do anything. If you're going to do any pruning, you do that in either the dead of winter or early spring. But I advise you to mulch it with compost, no more chemical fertilizer. And then once the fruits start forming, then I think it would be really smart to protect the tree. Bird netting is what you're going to have to use. What you want to do is pound some stakes or get some bamboo into the ground around the tree, put the netting over top of it, and then have a way you can pull it closed at the bottom. And that way your fruit will be protected without you being out there every day waving a broom around and yelling and screaming at creatures.
Thank you for straightening me out.
All right, Bob. I hope you get some pears next year, man.
Yeah, me too. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, good luck, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Melissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Melissa, where are you?
I'm currently located in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania.
Right.
I am part of an organic community garden located in Conshohocken, and we're in our third season of gardening currently, and we have grown to about 80 plots, and we love your show, so we're really grateful that you'd be able to take our question today. My question today is in regarding to concerns with mosquito spraying recently in our county. The spraying was conducted near our garden as recently as last week. And we were hoping you could tell us more about the harmful effects of mosquito spraying and how we may be better prepared as gardeners to limit the negative effects that this may have on our organic garden in the future.
How did they spray? Did they have a truck drive by or did they use helicopters?
We're pretty sure that it was a truck that drove by certain sections of the street.
But nobody saw it or heard it?
It was a bulletin that was put out by the health department, scheduled spraying with maps of how they were going to be. And it wasn't a social, it was a social media post by the actual Department of Health that was doing the spraying. So I'm pretty confident that it did occur.
So on this social media post, which I presume was on Facebook or something?
It was on their main website and then also posted on their Facebook page.
Okay, so on Facebook, you can have all of the residents of Conshohocken hit this Facebook page like nobody's business. That's probably the area where they're going to notice the bulk of complaints. But then you guys have to get together and you have two options. One, there's an organization called Beyond Pesticides. And their website is real easy, beyondpesticides.org. They will help you mobilize. They will help you know what your rights are and the right ways to go about it. There is also the Rachel Carson Council. Obviously, this is in the late Rachel Carson's wheelhouse. This is the kind of thing that she was trying to prevent. And besides contacting these organizations for, like, evidence, actionable things, and advice, you need to actually make sure that you can meet with these people from the health department and explain to them that mosquito spraying doesn't work. The statistics are, like, horrifying. It's, like, less than 0.1% of the spray ever reaches a mosquito, but it does tremendous damage to bees and beneficial insects and fish. It makes much more sense, and communities around the country have had much better experiences investing in BTI. BTI is a naturally occurring soil organism. Everybody's seen it for sale in hardware stores and home centers as those little donut-shaped dunks. You throw them in standing water. And it prevents mosquito larvae from developing. It is completely natural and organic. It only prevents the adulthood of mosquitoes, black flies, and biting midges. Has no negative effects on anything, including fish and toads and people. And communities have invested in buying bulk BTI in granules and donuts and even distributing them to people in the neighborhood. In addition to that, contact your elected representatives. They are your spokespeople in cases like this. At the very least, you want to be able to make sure that your garden doesn't get sprayed.
Thank you for clarifying that for us. We're so proud of our garden in the third year. You know, we have a healthy population of bees, toads, and we were really afraid when we heard about this spraying that we weren't quite sure of what negative effects it could have on our garden in the future. And, you know, we had some members that went and covered their plots with tarps. I don't know if that would have helped
no,
at all.
No. In terms of the vegetables and stuff, that's a can of corn. You just, no matter, even if you grew it organically yourself, you never let it out of your sight. You always wash your stuff when you bring it inside. But you can't protect the toads, and they're amphibians. Their porous skin makes them very susceptible to insecticides. We know that bees are like both eyes are closed. They don't know what city they're in as they're trying to come out for the 14th round. They are just impossibly hammered by these pesticides. And beneficial insects that we don't even think about and take for granted, they go down like a clown. And years later, you have all these stink bug problems and squash bug problems in your garden. You're trying to figure out what went wrong, and it's because of the truck that blew through three times last year.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that information. That is really helpful, and we are certainly going to make this a priority in Conshohocken.
Go rattle their cage, Melissa.
We will. We'll get it done.
Okay.
I'll update you on our progress for sure.
Very good.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. So you want to grow a giant sequoia. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's humongous question.
Sure, Mike. Brian in Camden County, New Jersey writes, I would like to grow a giant sequoia in my backyard. My property is very narrow, and there isn't a lot of choice for placement. The tree could only be 20 or 30 feet away from our driveway. The yard currently has some mature trees that form a canopy about 75 feet up, but the area does get sunlight for a good part of the day. It's not wet or swampy, but water can pool up there for a few hours. Do I have a chance of success? Well, does he?
Well, of course, first I had to email this guy back to ask why. His response was, gee, that's the same question my wife keeps asking me. I like the idea of planting a tree that might live longer than 1,000 years. It seems like a way for me to somehow escape my mortality. If it's still there after 1,000 years, it's because I planted it.
But giant sequoias only grow on the West Coast, right?
The two trees we're talking about here only exist naturally in very tight ranges west of the Rockies. But there have been attempts to grow them just about everywhere. There's a giant sequoia right near us at Tyler Arboretum in Media, PA, that's said to have been planted around 1840. And there's a really beautiful specimen that survived for 100 years at an estate in Rhode Island.
Wait, there are two different giant trees?
Yes. The, quote, giant sequoia, whose species name is Gigantium, occurs naturally in groves on the western slopes of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The name sequoia honors a Native American who helped preserve the Cherokee language. They're the biggest trees on Earth by sheer volume, but they're not the tallest. The biggest surviving one, named General Sherman, tops out only at around 275 feet. And forget a mere millennium of life. In their natural habitat, trees of this species can live more than 3,500 years. The other huge tree is the giant redwood. That species name is Sempervirens, sometimes called the Coast Redwood or California Redwood. They grow naturally along the Pacific in a thin strip from Monterey up to Lower Oregon. And there are 8 living specimens that are well over 300 feet tall. But they're much shorter lived in their native environment. They can only survive for about 1,000 years.
And outside of their environment?
Both trees seem to do exceptionally well in some parts of Europe and places like Australia. In the United States, they're almost common in the Pacific Northwest, especially around Seattle. Otherwise, the book says they do better in the South than in the Northeast U.S., but some arboretums and estates have kept giants alive on the East Coast since virtually the time of their, quote, discovery by non-indigenous peoples in the early to mid-1800s.
That makes them sound almost hardy.
Well, they're not. Mike Karkowski, director of horticulture at Tyler Arboretum, is pleasantly amazed at the more than 150-year survival of their specimen, but notes that it's the only survivor of many that were planted at that same time. And homeowner trees, in his opinion, generally only last about 20 years. They're prone to many problems outside their range. And when and if they get big enough, they need reliable fog to continue to survive.
Fog?
Yeah, once a tree reaches a certain height, it can't pump water up to its canopy. And so these giants have evolved to take their water from fog. And I can assure you that fog is very reliable in their area. When I spoke in Eureka a few summers ago, I learned firsthand that their little airport was created during World War II so that pilots could train in guaranteed foggy conditions.
And what about the coast redwood?
There are apparently a few that have survived 20 years at an estate in the Hamptons, but giant sequoias seem to be the tree of choice for adventurous home growers.
So, what's your advice to our listener?
Well, you know, his standing water sounds like a real deal breaker. These trees also need to be sheltered from the winter wind, but have a lot of airflow during hopefully non-humid summers. And most of the long-term survivors have had the benefit of professional arboretum staffers on hand all their lives. But if he or any of our other listeners still wants to try, they should visit local arboretums with specimens for advice. And I'd avoid buying souvenir seedlings from California, unless you live out there, of course. Several cold hardy varieties have been bred specifically for the adventurous amateur arborist.
And if he succeeds, will the tree, quote, make him immortal?
Well, not unless he can ensure that that land is safe from other uses for the next 1,000 years or so. A better way to achieve that goal might be with a bonsai. These trees train very well, and there are bonsais alive today that are well over 500 years old. This way, his spirit could live on in a tree that his descendants can take with them as they move around, as opposed to one that gets cut down to make room for a gas station in 2035. Well, that sure was an interesting look at the world's two tallest trees, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots more info about these titanic trees, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to sequester my sequoia if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. And you know, if you do send us an email, please, please, please tell us your location. Tell us where you live. Oh, it's so important. Oh, please, please, please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's web page wonders. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and see what's new every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our editor is Al Banks. Vertically challenged Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Normally heighted Peter Christian is our ace production assistant. Our hired hand, Matt Hudecki, is a certified beanpole. I'm the incredible shrinking man, Mike McGrath, and I'm going to find some way to counteract the effects of that radioactive mist so that you can see me next week. Down here. Lovely is the shrub known as lavender. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what it takes to grow this plant of a different color. Plus your fabulous phone calls.